Hello, this is Jeremy Swenson. I'm the CEO of Abstract Forward Consulting. We are a consultancy that focuses on cybersecurity, risk management, process improvement, and change management strategy consulting. We use disruptive thinking to solve these problems. This is our podcast, and today's topic is data classification. In the studio today, we have a renowned senior governance, risk and compliance, and critical infrastructure expert and former Air Force personnel, Jim or James Danberg. He's going to go ahead and give a brief introduction of his background, and then we'll get into the topic of data classification. Jim, go ahead.
Thank you, Jeremy. Yes, as Jeremy said, I'm a former Air Force, where I served as a communications security and non-commissioned officer, or sergeant. And I've worked with a number of different sectors, including critical infrastructure, telecommunications carriers, managed services providers. Also have been a speaker with a number of different groups, including Uptime Institute, AFCOM, Critical Infrastructure Protection Congress, which is an amalgamation of different groups and all rolling up to Homeland Security. I've dealt with a lot of different domains, and Jeremy tapped me to do this, have this conversation with him, because he knows that information classification is one of my favorite topics.
Thanks so much for that intro. And let's just start at the very beginning, reminding everybody in our audience really what data classification covers. There are four types of data classifications in the private or business sector space, and that would start at the company confidential level, would then move to be the private level, then would be the sensitive level, and then, of course, would be public. And that would be information you would find on the web. Every company has policies around how they define the governance and use of those types of data, and Jim is an expert in all that. And I'm going to give some statistics around the cost of data storage, because it's particularly interesting. In 1995, it cost $277 per gigabyte of disk storage. That is a lot of money. That price went down to $7.77 in the year 2000. Then in 2010, it was 11 cents. That's 11 cents per gigabyte of disk storage. Today, it is roughly 2 cents per gigabyte of disk storage. It's hugely interesting. And on the flash side of things, flash is a newer type of solid state memory. And flash really wasn't even around until about the year 2000. And in the year 2000, for a gigabyte of flash, it was $1,255. Then in 2010, it went down to $1.76. In 2017, it is 32 cents for a gigabyte of flash memory. So that's a really interesting statistic. And for a lot of organizations, it's easier just to retain the data than to risk not having the data. And so I want to get into some questions based off of Jim's experience around some data classification tips. So the first question is, how do we make sure to not equate data classification with data security?
Well, simply put, data classification is one step in information security. In other words, it's basically saying, taking a piece of information and putting it in a classification. There's many steps that you have to go to secure that information, including, besides just classifying, mapping the need-to-know paths. Who should have access to it? And that can be based on role-based access, or RBAC, as it's sometimes referred to.
So in your mind, Jim, what are some tips for knowing who should have access to your most critical data?
Well, from a standpoint of setting what is the most critical data, oftentimes organizations look at their intellectual property first and foremost. And the intellectual property, if it is copyrightable or patentable, there is certainly many guidelines in the governance world on how to deal with that information. Where the issues really come into play and it becomes more difficult is those process pieces that are part of doing business every day. And it's such mundane things as customer lists, bill of materials, processes that are done for clients that maybe actually belong to the clients from a standpoint of actual rights, but who within the organization should have the need to know about those pieces? Is it a fundamental part of them performing their task?
Got it. And I think a good way for us to think about who needs to have access to it is to imagine a disaster. Imagine a huge disaster, whether it's ransomware or whether it's a flooding or a hurricane. That is a situation that's going to tell you and remind you what your most critical data is. The data that if it's gone, you can't do your business. You can't serve customers. You can't make money, right? That's how we should think about what is the most important data. And so we need to map out what are the dependencies to that data. And to your point, you know, who are the people within the organization that need to have access to that data, and how does that change over time? But this concept of overclassification is brought up a lot in the technological journals. What are some of your thoughts and experience points with overclassification?
The overclassification is oftentimes used as a stumbling block. And part of that is that people say, well, if it's classified as not being able to be shared, it's going to interfere with our ability to collaborate, etc. The one thing about overclassification, a couple of things. Simplification in the classifications. Actually, many of the real pioneers in this space have pointed to the fact that you probably should have no more than actually 3 classifications. And also that information is not static, it's dynamic. So the classification of information can change over time and should be monitored as such.
It's a very good point. And it's also an interesting point on saying the 4 traditional corporate classification categories, you're saying that should be rolled back to 3 and make it simpler and to help force those decision makers to put it into this bucket or that bucket. Let's not overcomplicate this. In my experience, I have seen overclassification of data. And I think part of the reason why organizations do it is they're trying to protect their intellectual property and they're trying to reduce litigation. And then also, like I said in the introduction, the cost of storage is so low and it's continuing to go incrementally lower that storing it really isn't that expensive. And so if they have to save it and they classify it as in one of the higher classification types, then that supports overclassification. But to your point, when you overclassify, then fewer people can collaborate and debate out better ideas to improve the organizational operations. So I think there's a fine balance between, you know, sharing the data, classifying the data, and, you know, being innovative. So we just talked about overclassification, but the opposite coin of that is underclassification, or to a more greater extent, misclassification. Jim, what is your experience with those two, and what are some insights you have on that?
Well, sometimes information can either be under or misclassified if its value is not recognized. In other words, taken by itself, it may not be a particular value. However, if coupled with another piece of information, it then becomes of a different value and should be looked at as a different classification. So sometimes that does come into play. And again, the dynamic nature of things. But another area is the area of actually the marking of the classification. I have witnessed a number of scenarios where information was properly classified. One, for example, dealt with a Vizio. I was brought in by the CISO to find out why an uncleared individual was given this documentation. Now, it was a vendor it was shown to, and the vendor did have functional needs to see this information, but they had to bring in one of their subject matter experts that was not cleared. Well, this individual was, you know, a subject matter expert of the vendor. This individual was not cleared to see this information. When that was revealed, the CISO asked me to go in and do an examination and find out why this happened. Well, it was a 5-page Vizio. It was properly classified, but the marking of that classification was on the 5th page in mouse font. And I'm looking at this going, where's the watermark? Information, from a standpoint of the most sensitive type, what this was considered. It was network information for a member of critical infrastructure. It should be so clear that you know that this is eyes, you know, in the military they called it eyes only, for example. Okay? So that's marked. Well, I go back to the CISO. The CISO says, okay, you need to go and talk to this person in corporate legal to let them know what we're going to have to do. I made this, had a meeting with this person in corporate legal. And I explained to this individual what was going to need to be done from a standpoint of going through and at least the highest classification form they would have to watermark. This individual, it's like a crack appeared in this person's forehead and a bright light came shining out. And I thought I was about to meet some sort of creature from Ghostbusters. This person said, "We don't have the budget to fix this." Well, that's the whole point. And this person also said, "Do you realize how many thousands of documents we have that we're going to have to go through and do this with?" Well, the real remediation is actually turned out to be quite simple. It'll go forward. All of the most sensitive information was going to be digitally watermarked. So whether you printed it out or looking at it digitally, you're going to know. B, a budget was established and a process was put in place to go back on a retroactive basis and backfill and correct all of that past information. Now, because the CISO had the charter from the board to go in and find out what needed to be fixed and fix it, that's where the budget was coming from. And that is one of the biggest issues sometimes also is the discovery of how information is classified, but also where does it exist? Sometimes it may exist in all kinds of rat holes, some of them known as SharePoint sites.
You know, there's a lot of rat holes in these large corporations, aren't there?
Well, even in small ones.
Right, but at big ones, there's just so many of them. So I want to stop and redigest something you just said. And that was two separate pieces of data by themselves could be classified, say, for example, as public. You have two separate pieces of data.
Right.
And by themselves, they're public. But if you look at the classification judgment criteria, when they're combined, maybe they'd be sensitive. And there may even be three elements. And so a classification system and the training around how we classify companies needs to take that into account, that it's not just one piece of data in a silo that you use to classify.
Need to look to see how that information is actually used, especially as we move forward into, you know, the whole area of big data analytics.
Right, that one piece of data can be used and entered into other systems and databases to retrieve other information, and then it gets to be a real big can of worms because how can you know that far down the tree what other elements are going to be open from one piece of data, right? That's really hard. I guess you start at the bottom and say, what is this data? Who uses this data? Which of the three, or if we're using the longer four categories, does this data fall into? And then to your point, we can't think of it as static. We need to evaluate it on a regular basis and know how our organization and system changes such that if we need to elevate the status of classification for a particular data set, we'll do that.
Absolutely. And the other point to this is that if the business is subject to regulatory compliance, then you've got another set of...
You're talking about legal costs, you're talking about regulatory fines, those types of things?
Not just regulatory fines, but you have another criteria that you have to apply to the classification and how that information can be presented, even from a standpoint of evidence to that regulatory body. And in that case, then you have to do heavy redaction, et cetera. Yeah, there's a number of different points that roll into this question that you just brought up.
So I want to ask you a question about third-party risk management. I want to give an example of PCI data. A lot of companies want to shift the PCI data risk to a third party, meaning they want to do business, they want to make money. But when it comes to that financial payment transaction, they've outsourced all of that, where that data is going to be housed on the servers of that third party. They're not even touching it. They have no compliance obligation to that part of the data because they're not doing it. And there's a whole subset of businesses that do just that. They process the payment, they secure it, and that's their business model. What are your thoughts on that example, but shifting the data classification to a third party?
And this is an area that as long as things are firewalled appropriately, and actually that is one of the things, you can only shift that risk to third parties when indeed you've got the firewalls between. And this gets into the legal aspects of it, and also from a standpoint of the fiduciary as well.
I want to talk now about insider threat. I know you've had some experience to insider threat. What are some of your insights on insider threat?
Well, when I had my consulting business, I was privileged to have as some of my associates, people that came out of the military, intelligence organizations, and also federal law enforcement that worked with me. And they had some very, very interesting insights into insider threats. But just recently, New Republic had a press release that an individual some folks may be familiar with because he's well known as a trainer out there, a fellow by the name of Ray Semko. This New Republic came up with this whole thing about how CEOs of organizations oftentimes are some of the, and senior management are sometimes the worst violators of information security practices and procedures set by their own organizations. In Ray's post, he mentioned that 72% of CEOs admit to having taken valuable information from previous employers. So the insider threat can actually start at the top. And of course, it goes down as far as down to the lowly salespeople who always have their own copy of their customer lists.
Well said. And having been at a number of organizations, around 12 myself, and having interacted with leaders at most of these organizations, I would agree with you that those at the very top get very comfortable, and there's a lot of people around them that are afraid to say no. And this kind of goes beyond data classification as a topic, but it's totally relevant. If at the top, the culture isn't such that we're conforming to our data classification procedures and policies, then it's going to trickle down below. And many of the people high at the top don't even understand the details of a good data classification policy or procedure. And now I want to ask you, in your experience, if an organization, let's just say their data classification policies and procedures were a little bit archaic, a little bit outdated, maybe they were just acquired by a bigger entity, or maybe they sold off a part of business, but for whatever reason, they're behind the eight ball with these policies and procedures. What are your tips for an organization to improve them?
Well, first off, from a standpoint of how to improve, I'm going to mention something that occurred at a conference that was held here in Minneapolis in June, which was the BurCon, which is a security conference that's really quite unique because it is sponsored by various corporate entities here in the Twin Cities. It's not sponsored by any vendor, so there's no vendor crosstalk going here or talk about shiny objects. The CISO panel that was being held got asked a question regarding this very type of point. In other words, for your intellectual property that is not copyrightable, patentable, but process-related, such things as customer lists, bill of materials, even some of the mundane things such as that, how to properly protect it from a standpoint of the inside of the potential of insider threat. And what was interesting is that for publicly held companies, the boards, according to this panel, really understand the issue. The quandary comes down to the mid-level management team, oftentimes not enforcing some of the policies or understanding how they could be or should be empowered. Now, to answer your question as far as some great guidelines and whatnot, again, getting to the classifications, remember the old principle of KISS, keep it simple, stupid. Let's get down to as few classifications that make sense for the particular business or organization. Secondly, from a standpoint of, don't forget to map the need to knows. Who really needs this information in the daily performance of their duties? It may not be the case where a direct supervisor needs access to it, but his or her direct reports may. These are some of the, I would say, real simple kernels, real basic planks that need to be put together to help organize that.
And back to over-retention, I want to bring up frivolous litigation. I think organizations want to delete data they don't need, especially big organizations. Even though the cost to retain the data is really low and it's going lower and lower, having data that you don't need to retain is a risk, because when you have the data, you still have to deal with it. And if you delete the data and there's no legal requirement for you to keep the data, deleting it is a very good option. So I want to ask you, in your experience, what are some of the things an organization needs to do to really be ready for and to delete that data and to get rid of that frivolous litigation risk?
Okay. One of the things is to have a technology disposal policy. And by technology, I'm talking about not just the equipment, but the information held within those systems as well. And to that point, for example, a standard used in the critical infrastructure space, in particular the power utility industry, they have their Critical Infrastructure Protection Standard, or known as SIP. Well, SIP, when it was created, never had a technology disposal standard. And that incorporated that dealing with that information as well. And I think that from that standpoint, coming up with a policy of what happens when things are at end of life or end of program life, whatever term that the organization needs to use, this whole idea of disposal of that information needs to be there.
So they need to document how they're going to dispose of this data, and that may be systems as well. So take maybe you have a bunch of old computers. Maybe you've just had them. Maybe they've just been there and they still have data in the RAM and in the hard drives, but you just need to get rid of them. So you need to securely, you don't just throw them in the trash, right? That's not what you do. You need to send them to a vendor that knows how to securely and properly.
They need to be sanitized.
Sanitized.
And actually, it was very interesting in the case of one client that I worked with. They had two very major vendors, one that dealt with the servers and those the more heavy duty systems, and another vendor that dealt with basically the desktops and laptops. One vendor was great at those sanitation requirements, which for SIP were pretty stringent. The other vendor, not so much. So the trick is that you really need to come up with a plan that suits your particular organization's needs from a standpoint of regulatory compliance and also best security practices.
A lot of people in this social media era make the statement, privacy is dead. And many have repeated this. If you're a CIO or if you're a CISO, you may be assuming or nearly assuming that something that is now private will soon be public. What do you think the right balance is with social media and this increasing sharing of information to sort of deal with this?
It's a very interesting and somewhat vexing question, because like they that's often said now about social media, don't put anything out there that you don't want the world to know, because the world's going to know it. In the case of protecting information that has monetary value to the organization, this is where you really have to look at things from as many angles as possible from a standpoint of how something can be absconded with.
So scanning the darknet, paying for third-party organizations to go out there, scan the dark web, to look at all these malicious databases to see, is there a clue that your data is there? We know it's in social media, the public stuff, but what happens a lot of times is, so the public stuff is the low-hanging fruit, right? So your company acquires X company, or your company, you know, secures $50 million additional financing. That's a good thing to be retweeted and to be reposted in Facebook. That'll be shared. But where it gets more complicated is when you have insiders who then post something that gives away a key piece of information that they really shouldn't have said. And so drip by drip, you have additional pieces of information coming out, and they're all out there. And so organizations have to have a way to monitor this. And actually, the authorities, the police, they're monitoring social media. They're monitoring the internet to try to find clues for would-be criminals who are in the planning stages. And corporations, they got to be doing that somewhat to figure out, is there data on the black market? And are they being a target for a data breach? So any thoughts or examples that you've seen where companies have really got that done well?
Well, Jeremy, you're absolutely right on. And being aware of what's being put out there on the dark web, that is a huge piece of intelligence work that more organizations should be taking an active role in. Many are, but there's always room for improvement. From a standpoint of who's doing it well, for example, InfraGuard, which is an organization many people have heard of, but some may have not, and it's an organization that's run by the FBI. It is a share between federal agencies and private industry of relevant information security, physical security risks, disaster planning, all types of different elements. And for example, there is a great example of insider activity that occurred down at the Mayo Clinic. And this goes back a number of years, has been talked about a lot, and it was a researcher. And this researcher had absconded with a whole bunch of research information and was literally caught while he was on honeymoon in Hawaii on his way back to the Far East. Interestingly enough, this case was kept very, very quiet. It was only the fact that a stringer for Reuters happened to be at the federal courthouse and found out about the warrant being issued for this researcher's arrest that resulted in the news coming out on this. This is probably about almost 20-year-old story, but this was handled by both federal and local law enforcement authorities that were able to track this individual down and find out what he was up to.
And researchers are of noted concern because they are experimenting with things that are soon to be patents or viable revenue-generating products.
Correct. And the other part is that they're collaborative by nature. This one was taking other people's research information because he had some access to it, and he also nefariously developed unauthorized access to it. So that's yet another really good example. Now, there's another group that is also heavily involved in collaboration with our federal law enforcement, and that is called the FSISAC. That's FS-ISAC. That stands for Financial Services Information Sharing and Analysis Center. Since the formation of Homeland Security and the 16 different silos within it, there are now different types of ISACs being stood up. But the FSISAC is the oldest one. It goes back over 25 years now, and it serves the financial services industry. And they actually have a tremendous information sharing program of threats, actors, tools, you name it, they have it. And actually, when there are incidents that involve, they are actually pulled into the National Cyber Command Incident Center, or NCIC, which, where they huddle with FBI Cyber Crime Task Force, Secret Service, and many times lettered agencies as well.
And you know, they make mistakes just as often as any private organization, if not more often. We shouldn't assume that, you know, everybody in InfraGuard or one of these three-letter agencies is always right. They're not, because you know your business entity better than anybody. It's your business. You know your customers. You should know your regulations, and you should know your data. It's your business. You got to know it. You got to be responsible for it. You can't rely on these collaborative groups to solve every problem. They're a good source when you want to go to them because you think there's pre-clues to an incident. They're definitely a good collaboration group, but ultimately, you got to own your own data and your own risk. And if you do it well, you're going to have a competitive position in the market. I want to ask a different question, and that's really related to mobile devices, the smartphone, tablets, and things like that, and this concept of containerization. So before the smartphone, before the pads, you know, we work from home really mostly on an IBM ThinkPad, and that data needed to be protected, obviously. But now that we're using hybrid devices that have both personal and company data on them, this containerization concept is really important. So there's software tools that they can go on to the smartphone or the tablet and separate out the personal data and the company data in this process called containerization. It means that all of the company data is in a secure encrypted container and can't talk to or see your private text messages about your dinner or your night out at the game, things like that. Organizations need to be employing a mobile device management tool so that they can containerize the data appropriately and have the right classification scheme to it. So if an employee who is, you know, has a pad and has a smartphone is subject to investigation related to a breach, they're going to be able to go ahead and investigate his mobile devices, but his private personal communications will be protected. Because a lot of times there's pushback from the civil rights lawyers that say, look, this employee has private information and private rights, and you have no right or reason to know about his or her marital status or religious beliefs or anything like that. Have you seen anything around those topics?
The issue with the whole information classification being dynamic, you know, we're at a point in time where, from a standpoint of, we're talking about big data, we're talking about continuous development, we're talking about agile, we're talking about, you know, application containerization, all of these things. The simple fact is that the information classification side of things is still this process that is seldom reviewed and seldom fed into the dynamicism of the environments that we have going on to date and where we're moving as far as organizations. So in other words, just like at the IANS conference recently, there was made mention of the whole idea of embedding and working directly with the DevOps teams, because the DevOps teams are doing continuous development, which means security needs to become part of their whole cycle. Has it been? Yes, but it's oftentimes kind of there as an afterthought. Same thing is true from compliance, and the same thing should be there from a standpoint of information classification. It has to become dynamic, not just this once a year review procedure. That's where the big change, an almost disruptive change, needs to affect. It's another one of these issues that needs to be brought into this whole big cycle of change that we have going on.
Thanks everybody for tuning in, and a special thanks to our guest Jim Danberg. We are Abstract Forward Consulting, where we solve cybersecurity, process improvement, risk management, and change management problems via disruptive thinking. Reach out to us at abstractforward.com